same time, nobody will be embarrassed later by having it go off and would interfere with the sound quality as well. Second of all, I'd like to tell you about our three upcoming events in the next couple of weeks. First of all, tomorrow we have Mei Li. She used to be with CNN. She now hosts a talk show that some of you may have seen from Singapore. She's going to be talking about women in the media in Asia. Then next Monday, we have Johan Bjorksten. He is a well-known consultant for a lot of Scandinavian companies in China, as well as for Chinese companies that have invested in Scandinavia. He'll be talking about how to promote foreign brands in an increasingly nationalistic China, and I suspect also a lot of people will have questions on how they think that the Geely acquisition of Volvo Cars is going to work out. Then the next event, actually, I just want to make sure everybody's aware that we have rescheduled Mark O'Neill. He was going to be speaking, next week, and he's been pushed back at his request to the 2nd of June because of delay in the publication of his book. And he'll be speaking on the world's largest NGO, which is the Tsu-Chi, the largest NGO in the Chinese world, which is the Tsu-Chi Foundation, which has been very active in doing relief work all over China, particularly in the Sichuan earthquake. I'm sure they're there by now in the Qinghai earthquake as well. So again, that's been moved back to June 2nd. With that, I'd like to introduce our guest today, Brian Brown. Certainly, financial regulation has been very much in the news, particularly in the last few days, but even for the last couple of years. Brian saw an opportunity for a book when so many of the quantitative trading programs and techniques fell apart in August of 2007 in the earliest warnings of what became the subprime and then broader financial crisis. He had 8 years of experience at Morgan Stanley. He's now the founder of a new company, the Shogi Group, which he'll tell you about as well. With that, I'd like to introduce Brian. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I came over here on Friday, in fact, to take a look at the venue, and as I was walking up the stairs and looked at the William Holden poster and got a sense for the ambiance here, suffice it to say, if I said I was honored to be here today, that's an understatement. When I think of what this building represents to Hong Kong, a city which has become my home and where I met my wife and where we've started our family, so I appreciate the invitation. Honored to be here, and thank you all for coming today. To give you a little bit of the background of the book and a little bit more about my story to begin with, it was roughly 2 years ago that I left the bank, needing a breather, needing a transition, and writing a book seemed like a good idea at the time. And there are many different motivations, one of which my wife had just gone back to work, and I know that if I was at home responsible for the kids, she wouldn't sleep very well at night. So that was one of the issues, is we rented an office, and a small office, and decided to, starting on a book would be a good transition to keep you busy. The other thing, more subtle motivation, was my mother. And this might be familiar with some of you. My mother never understood what I did for a living. And that in itself might not be a problem, but from small town Canada originally, and my mother's always bumping into people at the grocery store, and I get a call, oh, I saw Mrs. Weinstein the other day, you know, she was asking about you, what do I tell her? You know, what do I tell her to do? She's really no, my background is applied mathematics. I guess what the problem with that is that it's not necessarily conventional understanding that mathematicians still work for banks, what do they do for banks? So part of the motivation was just to write something for the layman that would let the layman understand what exactly is this industry of quantitative finance, and there really is no label to put on other than that. So therein lies where we are today, 2 years later. The book is out chasing the same signals, and it's really a book on what is known as the black box industry, the industry of computerized trading, but not so much to help people understand what that is, to help people understand how they've impacted everyone else. Black box trading is hugely something in Asia that's not necessarily in the headlines, but in the US it's certainly a contentious topic. Probably 50% of all turnovers occur by computers today. So it's something that's not very well understood, how it's impacting everyone else, and that's the nature of the book. Now, today's talk I titled The New Economy of Equity Trading, because that to me is the crux of what's occurred in the marketplace, is a change in the business model that the banks have gone through as a consequence of black box trading. I think one thing we learned about in the financial crisis was that everyone is impacted by the economy. Everyone is influenced by the financial markets, whether you're an investor or not. And today, given the speed and pace of the markets are faster than ever, markets are more volatile today than they were during the Asia crisis, for instance. Everyone is adversely, our opinions of the market are adversely influenced by the speed and the pace. So today's talk is really more so about the changes that have occurred in the marketplace as a consequence of the black box movement. Now, to understand what is a black box, what is it we're talking about computerized trading, you have to start with the roots of what is exactly their role in the marketplace. So much the same way that a dealer or a floor trader or a sales trader for that matter is offering liquidity to the marketplace, whether it's executing client orders, whether it's offering a risk price on a basket, most traditional people in the marketplace are intermediaries. They are getting in between buyer and sellers, and they're remunerated based on commissions or based on differences between bids and offers. That's exactly what the black box industry represents. They are also in the business intermediaries, except they are doing it electronically. They are doing it using mathematical models to price stocks and to offer liquidity to the marketplace holistically. So they are competing with all the different existing intermediaries in the marketplace, and that is where they're so contentious, because they're dramatically impacting the traditional business model. They have lowered commissions in the U.S. dramatically. They've lowered spreads in the U.S. dramatically. As a result, they've displaced a number of existing people. As a bit of a background, quantitative trading has an extremely long history. It's been around for several decades. And I'm not going to go into much detail about exactly how models are developed, but I'll just start with the very, very simple example that everyone uses, the Coke and Pepsi example. Black box traders are generally not looking at forecasting necessarily a price movement outright. They're looking at the margins between correlated securities. So the Coke and Pepsi example is always used because those products share the same risk. They ultimately move in the same direction over the course of time. But in the short term, they deviate, they drift from those things because of imbalances in supply and demand. And black box trader quants, as we're called, can look at the margin between correlated securities, model that statistically, and we can recognize imbalances in the marketplace in the short term that have a high propensity of reversing. That's the most common mean reversion strategy. And within a single security like Coke and Pepsi, that wouldn't necessarily be a very good strategy. But when you can do that across thousands of securities holistically, you can look at margins and you can do it over and over again. You can gain tiny little margins as a consequence of inefficiencies that occur and individual traders or dealers couldn't necessarily recognize. That's the foundation of what is the black box industry. What does this mean to everyone else? Now, when I joined the industry in the mid-90s and I was working for a firm called Trout Trading, which is one of the largest, most active traders in the world, we still had a trading desk. There was quantitative trading, but it looked much differently in the mid-1990s. That being, we had a trading desk that stared at trading screens and they had beeps and alerts that went off through the day and let them know when to buy, when to sell. Our traders were predominantly there for execution. They had to phone in the orders to the floor of the CME, or they had to call different brokers to route the orders around. But they were still governed, their decisions were governed by the models behind it. The world started to change in roughly 1998 when Reg ATS went through in the US and interactive brokers started to launch APIs out to hedge funds. And what that did is gave hedge funds the tools to start interacting with exchanges electronically. No need to phone in orders. They could route them to the market explicitly and execute in real time. So as a result, the industry started to change. This is what I call kind of the birth of the electronic trading movement. Now, there's been so many different regulatory reforms and different occurrences that have also accelerated that growth. So whether it's movement to desks whether it's Reg NMS, most recently even a bundling of subprime crisis. There's been a number of reasons interrelated that have propelled the growth of electronic trading, which is now globally, it's hard to put a figure on it, but it's at least 40% of all turnover is electronic now. More importantly, out of all that time period, is the economics of the industry have changed. What's occurred is this dramatic compression of commissions as a consequence of now having low-touch execution. There's no reason for a bank to phone in to a desk, for an institutional manager to phone in an order to a desk and pay 25, 30 basis points, high-touch commission, as they call it, when they can route that electronically and use all the tools that have been developed along the way. So what that's done is changed the economics of the banking model, the traditional banking model. And I believe we're still at the infancy of that movement. This was occurring long before the subprime crisis occurred. The economics were changing. It's one of the main drivers why banks are increasing the risk and their leverage over the years, because commissions were being eroded away. They didn't know how to adjust to the new business model. And that's where we are today. It's still at the infancy of that. Stated otherwise, a decade ago, we had very much a business which was dominated by long only. It represented probably 90% of the turnover in the marketplace, exchanging blocks back and forth. A decade later, now we have a colossal amount of liquidity providers doing all these different arbitrage type strategies. Now, assets wouldn't reflect this. We wouldn't notice this by looking at the assets invested in different alternative strategies. We'd only notice this by looking at the turnover metrics that occur on a day-to-day basis. And there's few insiders that would actually be aware of how colorful what the specific buckets look like. So what's the overall effect on the marketplace, and what does this mean to Joe Investor? Well, quite clearly, the markets are more efficient than ever. They're efficient, maybe not to the retail investor sees that, but commissions that are occurring for traditional asset managers have come down, spreads have come down, markets are less trendy, more efficient, more ability to do larger scale. So the marketplace really benefited from this entire movement. That's not really debatable. What's debatable are what are the tails? What are the tails of the impact to investors? So put it in context, you know, anyone here in Hong Kong might have remembered last March, HSBC Holdings was knocked down 22% in the closing auction momentarily, and it snaps back the next day. Now, the press reported this as some sort of program error, you know, the exchange investigated. But there's so much more going on behind the scenes than simply just saying that this is some sort of program error. This is a consequence of the economics of the industry is changing. This isn't necessarily an algorithm that's gone wild. What's occurred behind the scenes is you've had this massive market fragmentation where banks, because commission pressure, they're using algorithms internally. So even if a asset manager is paying for high-touch execution, sending that to a sales trader, that's going into machines that are worked. And that's because they want to reduce the amount of people involved in executing orders so they can maximize the profit margins. Upwards of 50, 60% of all orders within banks go into some sort of trading algorithm. And the consequence of that is that there's a lot of anomalies that are occurring in the marketplace. This is the most dramatic that I think of, but it certainly is a good headline. Over my career, particularly in Asia, I've seen instances like this over and over, whether it's maybe like a 5% movement going into the closing market. But in fact, this is eroding our confidence in the economy. You know, my doorman, he inherited shares of HSBC from his father. He asked me about stuff like this almost every week as to what he should do with his money. If you think back last March, which was ultimately the lows in the marketplace, having this kind of volatility is just kind of further erosion to someone's interpretation of the economy. And how many people, you can't prosper necessarily off a movement like that, but how many people just decided I've had enough and traded out their positions over the subsequent weeks after that? The one major point that I hope people get out of my book and hopefully out of my talk, which is brief in many regards. We all know who the largest shareholders are in major stocks. We can find that out. That's very transparent. We can go to Yahoo Finance and find out who are the top 10 shareholders in, whether it's HSBC or Tong Kong. And it's going to be household names we're familiar with. It's going to be Fidelity. It's going to be Capital Research. It's going to be actually a list of people you've never heard of. It's Genco Securities. It's Two Sigma Highbridge. Some of these guys you've never heard of, they don't have a public face. James Simmons, one of the most successful investors of all time. No one's heard of him. Now, is there anything wrong with that? No, not necessarily. It doesn't matter that someone is 10 or 20% of the turnover in a stock because they're a market maker, necessarily. But if they're the one that's knocking a stock down 20%, that's a big distinction to Warren Buffett selling out of a position, right? The volatility that's created behind the scenes influences our perception and influences our decision making. And our regulatory framework is designed around constraining shareholders. We're designed around constraining large movements in blocks of shares. We have no constraints around constraining traders. Anyone can be 10, 20% of the market in a stock, provided they don't hold a position overnight. No one's the wiser. Our framework revolves around putting the onus on the broker to know their client. Well, in fact, the brokers have just become pipes in this entire electronic movement. In fact, in the U.S., hedge funds are bypassing brokers outright, connecting to exchanges directly, and just using the brokers for settlement. So we need to move with the times, and we need to look at giving people the transparency and the metrics on traders just the same as we do on holders. And just kind of lastly, to talk about, what's this mean for Asia? Well, it doesn't mean a lot to Asia right now. We do not have a black box industry in Asia, apart from banks having algorithms internally to work client orders. Why don't we have that? It's many different reasons, from regulatory restrictions, foreign restrictions in Korea and India, having to deal with swaps in India, stamp taxes in Hong Kong, Taiwan, the like that really make it very, very difficult to execute these markets electronically. So despite all the different interesting things going on around the region, the adoption of index futures in China, to direct market access in India, all these different things that should be beneficial, they also aren't really having a major impact on the marketplace right now, because every region's working independently of one another. Every region, like in Korea, wants to have onshore presence in Korea, when in fact, the entire region is connected economically. We're all aware that we're all subject to the fate of China and India and our export-driven market environment. So Taiwan is correlated with India, and it's correlated with Singapore and ASEAN. But you can't trade the entire region from one single point here. You can't hedge risk in Taiwan with ASEAN markets. It's just not that easy. It's not possible to trade the markets intraday as a consequence of all these different regulatory constraints that we have in place. We're moving in the right direction, but we're moving quite slowly. And if we move a bit faster, I think there would be a lot more benefits. So kind of lastly, I'm trying to keep it a little brief, and I know I've talked about a number of things that are a little bit disconnected. But the three major points. One, when you think of black box industry, high frequency trading, all the different names given to it, and it's more contentious in the US, but think of it in this very simple analogy. It's like the Walmart of the financial industry. They are offering liquidity, they're using models to manage inventory, much the same Walmart did in the retail space, where they looked at developing models to estimate their control of their inventory. Black box traders are offering that same service to home investors, and we're all benefiting. So this is a positive thing that's occurred. This is a very positive industry that's developed, and something that should be supported. It shouldn't be vilified the way that it is. Speed and the pace of today's market is definitely having an impact on how we interpret the marketplace. And for something that has a footprint of at least 40% of all global turnover, it needs to be as well understood as anything else out there that's influencing stock prices. And lastly, Asia, we're at our infancy. How long we stay at our infancy is anyone's guess. But this is something that I try to write about and put it in a context of what the opportunity is, and that's the crux of where I believe is the new economy headed. Now, thank you very much. I appreciate being able to come here and give you a brief talk. And I'll open it up for questions and answers, preferably kind of in the three main topics that I've identified.
Thank you very much. Take a seat, or you prefer standing?
I'll prefer standing.
Okay. Okay, over here on the side, please. Tom. And please introduce and identify yourselves, everybody.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. It's Tom Holland from the South China Morning Post here. How should these black box-driven funds be regulated? They're playing the role, in some ways, of an old-fashioned market maker, but they're not regulated market makers. In many ways, they're outside the regulatory system. How should they be overseen?
I think they definitely, there should be a separate category for regulating them. That's quite a good question, because a number of them go through the trouble of even getting broker-dealer licenses in particular environments so that they can get exemptions, stamp tax exemptions, for instance. And that's obviously, going through too much trouble to get a broker-dealer license is just a consequence of not having a regulatory framework which identifies them properly. So they should be regulated. They should be regulated different than other types of hedge funds. There should be some sort of category for them. And why I bring up the chart that I do of the holders versus the traders, that would be a consequence of how they should be regulated. We don't need to know, we don't necessarily need to put constraints and controls around how much turnover they can do in particular stocks, but we should make it their responsibility to report what their turnover is, whether it's a monthly report. They'll have all the metrics. It'd be a very simple framework that the regulators could adopt and just say on a monthly basis they report this, the same way that long onlys are required to report what their holdings are every quarter.
Okay, next. An uncommonly bashful group. Back in the corner here.
Yeah, hi, Steve Cook from Chi-X. I'm just on that previous subject. I just wanted to see what do you think is the reason that we should be asking for reporting of these highly active traders? What is the benefit to the end investor?
Up here, please. Just a moment for the mic, please.
My name is Balakrishnan. How far do you think this can logically go? I mean, you are trading on imperfections of people trading on some other basis, right? Fundamental basis and all that. You cannot possibly be 100%, right? Then you just be trading on what?
I'm not so sure I completely understood the question, so I'll answer it the way that I understood it. Correct me if I'm wrong. So how much further can it go in terms of your proficiency of forecasting, and how much money can you make purely based on technical? What percentage? Okay, it's actually a similar question, but there's got to be a sweet spot. Now they're subject to different economics, the same way all investment strategies are. Their economics happen to be volatility or spreads. So I suspect that it's a symbiotic relationship. They can't be 100% of the turnover. They would die off trading against one another. So probably the sweet spot is around 30 or 40%, not much higher. We don't have the transparency to know exactly what the total turnover is. So back in August 2007, which I did talk about today, that's where chasing the same signals came from, this quant meltdown that occurred in August 2007. Stocks were knocked all over the charts. The quants could have been as much as 80-90% of the turnover for a brief period. And then that's ultimately what caused the problems. In the marketplace, we need a balance between investment strategies. We don't have the metrics on that. We have no idea when there is an investment.
go.
Harking back to that 2007 crash, sorry, I'm James DeBeiser from Asian Investor. What was the, that obviously shows that at that point in time, most of the big players were all tracking the same plays and using the same risk models. To what extent have those top 10 traders that you there diversified their strategies and their risk models?
Well, there's no way I'd be able to answer that accurately, just given the culture of these guys, which was part of, you know, the book is chasing the same signals for a reason, because they have a very unique culture. These guys were all very secret. They live in Milwaukee or Connecticut, places where they shy away from the lights of Wall Street. So prior to that, we weren't really sure what they were doing, but we learned in that time that they were all running very similar strategies, and that's kind of the background of why chasing the same signals came about. Now, how have they diversified after that crisis? Partly, I think some of them, from what I understand, were running this contrarian strategy. That was one of the major issues, this mean reversion strategy, that, from what I understand, 30% of the assets in the funds that were trading that strategy have disappeared as a consequence of that. So the ones remaining are still have benefited now because there's less competition. What they've learned out of that, I guess, is the way to they need to constantly evolve. So some of them are looking at using location data to predict changes in the retail sector. Some of them are hiring meteorologists to look at weather data to analyze the impact of weather on the marketplace. So despite its name, Black Box, a very colorful industry.
If I can throw one in, you just briefly ended up having time to touch on why it's harder to do this kind of trading in Asia. And you mentioned, for example, that in India and Korea, they have a lot of regulatory restrictions. But why don't you see more between, say, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and Singapore? Why don't we hear of, for example, more people trying to offset maybe energy positions in Singapore against Chinese equity positions in Hong Kong? Why is that more limited here?
I think that there is hedging. There's obviously hedging going on between the regions, and I don't mean to suggest that there isn't any. But is there intraday arbitrage strategies here the way that there are in the U.S.? No way. Now, the reason being, so even between Hong Kong and Japan, as an example. Now, Japan has a big, well-established quant market there. But Hong Kong has 25 basis points of round-trip stamp tax. So you don't have... And we don't, by itself, it's not really necessarily a deep market. Yes, it's a $4 or $5 billion turnover, but that's across maybe 200 names. It's not a marketplace that has several thousand stocks like Japan has, where you can do all sorts of sector neutral strategies. So that's part of the reason is any one market within Asia, Japan is the exception where it's broad enough and deep enough in itself, and that's why there's a black box community. But most of the other markets themselves are sectors. You know, Singapore's a sector, Australia's a sector for that matter. So the exchanges and the regulators ultimately need to work together to facilitate this industry. Can't work independently.
Thank you. Okay, over here, please.
So I'm thinking back to your 1998 and 2009 pie charts. And in 1998, the vast majority of investments were long only, and now, of course, big chunk black box. How much of the profitability that would have otherwise accrued to the long only funds has been taken out of the market by the black box activity? And then a second somewhat related question, how does your knowledge of what's going on in the black boxes make you a smarter retail investor?
Two very tough questions. Unfortunately, the first one I can only estimate, and it would just be a gut estimate because I'm not quite sure what profits have been made. So when we talk about the black box community, and I didn't refer to it exclusively before, but I'm talking about maybe 2% of all assets are invested in black box type of firms. It's roughly a $200 billion, $250 billion are invested in black box firms, and that's concentrated within maybe 10 or 15 major firms, which are all very profitable, as we know. I mean, Renaissance Technology is amount of profits to them collectively as a whole, you know, it's probably $20 billion a year. That's probably a rough estimate, $20 to $25 billion a year, maybe a little bit more of return. So that money, my argument, why I was saying that they're an intermediary, is not coming out of returns that a long only would have made. It's in fact, it's coming out of commissions. It's coming out of spreads that traditional broker dealers would have made. So that's my analogy of the Walmart, is that they're ultimately another intermediary. So second question, how does my knowledge of all this stuff help me make money as a retail investor, which is a very tough question. But I fortunately working in Asia for the period that I have, we had access. So when I throw up those pie charts, you can't produce that in the U.S. And those are just ballpark figures from my experience. We can kind of estimate things like that transparency of turnover because of swaps, because of these things that make clients and asset managers consolidate their trading through one particular broker. So as a consequence of that, I have kind of a feeling for what the flows look like in this region and what the interrelationships for the flows. So my timing was very fortunate, leaving the bank 2 years ago, obviously ahead of the crisis, and being unencumbered by all the constraints of the workflow bank. But it's not like I'm sitting at home making black box strategies myself. I don't try to compete against the big boys. But what I do try to look at is what are the economics of the players? Who are the traders of particular stocks? That's one thing I always try to understand, not just who the investors are, who the traders. And I might not choose black box. It might be a local hedge fund that's punting a lot. It might be some sort of local broker that punts a lot. It might be due to warrant trading where there's a lot of derivative trading on the back of it. But I always try to understand what's the ecology, who's trading that stock. And if you can understand that, then you can have a little bit of an insight for sweet spots in the marketplace. And that's ultimately my strategy.
Okay, over here, please.
Hi, I'm Owen from The Economist. Since a lot of investors has moved to the black box trading, do you think people on this floor should at least consider investing in this area? Because it must be profitable for people to move into this area. Do you think it's practical for us to do this?
I completely agree. It's an important niche, and as I said earlier, they're subject to their own economics. So they've done extremely well in 2008, 2009, when markets were volatile. They didn't do very well in 2007, 2006, when everyone else was making money the old-fashioned way, buy and hold. So it's a further way of diversifying. Right? Now the problem is that it's not an industry where you're going to have thousands of funds and investment vehicles to select from. I'd love to put some money in Renaissance Technology, but I think they've been closed for 20 years. So there are no real local players that I can think of. There's some people that sell themselves as doing quant, doing a little bit of market neutral trading, but it's not quant in the U.S. sense of it. So it's definitely an area I think you should keep, as an investor, you should keep an eye on. And if the regulatory environment changes, there's certainly going to be an opportunity.
What would be the pros and cons of if the U.S. were to introduce even a very small stamp tax? Would you gain in terms of transparency of the market what you would lose in terms of liquidity from a lid on the quants?
That's the
Tobin tax or some version.
The Tobin tax, it's been talked about. I don't know how serious they are in the U.S., but that would dramatically be detrimental to volumes in the U.S. So if they're saying that black boxes are anywhere from 50% to, you know, I've heard higher numbers in the U.S. markets, that they're 50, 70% of the turnover. You introduce a transactional tax, the entire business, the economics of that business is going to change dramatically. So how will that impact everyone else? It would be a knock-on effect, very short-term knock-on effect. I can't think of a positive consequence of introducing that. One thing that is very, very clear is that we're all connected. So if they do introduce something in the U.S., whether it's short sell restrictions or some sort of increase on or constraints on leverage, that's going to have an effect on Asia. That's going to affect, because it's all interconnected. connected in terms of the economics of the industry. One area subsidizes another. You know, we've benefited in Asia because of this movement in the U.S., which has led to technology being developed and lowering our costs through these algorithms. They never would have been developed in Asia alone by themselves. So it's all interconnected. Open tax, I'm not a big believer.
And what was your take on the imposition of short-selling restrictions, particularly by Australia, although they spread through the region somewhat in, I guess, September and October of 2008? Was that effective or not?
Yeah, it was ultimately a non-event, I think, in this region. Why? Because the only people that are really dependent on it are the quants. Obviously, hedge funds are trying to punt and short, and they do short here, but the guys that are really impacted in the U.S., if we think back of October 2008, anyone watched CNBC night after night, you saw the market being knocked down 9%. It was then back up 7%, then down 10%. So why are we having all these bumps and oscillations? The black box firms have become today's stabilizers in the marketplace. They've displaced the specialists and the traditional market makers in that space. So when all of a sudden you constrain short selling and you take their flows out of the marketplace, you don't have that stabilizer in there. So I think people, short selling is a very, very contentious topic, obviously many different views, but it's beneficial to the marketplace in all regards, in my view. And the places that, like Germany, that are really taking this forward to constrain it ongoing, I think they will suffer more adverse volatility than what they're trying to compensate.
Okay, we have time for one more. We always try to stop at 2 o'clock sharp. Up here, please.
Jeremy Bolland. Can I just ask how? I understand the whole concept of black boxes and it's all number crunching, etc. But is it 100% objective, or is there any personal subjectivity that goes into it? For example, Goldman Sachs versus J.P. Morgan. Goldman Sachs suddenly drops 13% for good reason, and the other banks drop 1, 2, 3%, whatever. So would you be able to input your own subjectivity into that, or does the box churn out an immediate trade?
Well, that's a good question. There's a lot of misconceptions about it. The majority is the goal of them is to be highly as automated as they can, but of course they realize the limitations. They don't have crystal balls, and I don't think anyone would pretend to have crystal balls. So when they look at something like a Goldman Sachs, more so they're looking at trying to do risk management by knowing when there's an anomaly in the marketplace that the models wouldn't have accommodated for and be able to prevent trading a particular model in and around that. So there's a lot of discretionary and there's a lot of maintenance. Okay, they automate the stuff, like when I was saying at Trove Trading, we automated most of our trading desks, but that still had a role for the traders, but a different kind of role rather than execution. The other side of that is not all quants are the same. It's a very colorful industry. So if you look at Marshall Wace, which is in Asia, and they're very successful running one of these top strategies where they pull all the different brokers, the salespeople, for their opinions, and then they build a quant portfolio around that. That's like this hybrid trading model where they're actually looking for people's alpha, their discretionary opinions of what to buy and sell, and they measure the effectiveness of salespeople's calls, and then they put more risk behind that. So some really interesting and innovative ways of looking at the market. So it's not all just formulas and hope for the best.
Okay, with that, thank you all for coming. We'd like to thank all of our guests, and so give you something to remember the club by.
Thank you
very much for coming.
Thank you.
And we look forward to seeing many of you tomorrow if you want to be back for our next lunch tomorrow. Thank you all for coming. Bye-bye.